My guest on The Year That Made Me today is S. Shaktidharan, better known as Shakti. He's a Western Sydney playwright, author and filmmaker with Sri Lankan heritage and Tamil ancestry. Shakti arrived on the international stage with a bang in 2019 after his debut play, Counting and Cracking, premiered at the Sydney Festival. The play was an epic production that followed the journey of one Sri Lankan Australian family over four generations, and it received an epic response, winning 7 Helpman Awards, 3 Sydney Theatre Awards, and enjoying a sellout run at the Edinburgh International Festival. Shakti went on to win rave reviews for his follow-up plays and his deeply moving memoir, Gather Up Your World in One Long Breath. In April of this year, he won the Wyndham Campbell Prize for Drama, a prestigious international award that recognises his body of work. This week, The Jungle and the Sea, Shakti's second play about the Sri Lankan Civil War, returns to Belvoir Street Theatre in Sydney before moving on to Melbourne and Canberra. We're about to hear more about the real-life experiences that inspired this play and his other works. Shakti, who's got a bit of a cold, I should warn. Shakti, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Pleasure to be here, mate.
Let's go back to some of your own earliest experiences. Shakti, tell me about your childhood.
I had an unusual childhood. I was born in Sri Lanka, in Colombo, in 1982. When I was 1 year old, there were riots across Colombo against Tamil people, shops, homes and businesses. And the capital city, all the Tamil areas, ended up being on fire. And it was a pogrom against my community. And my great-grandfather was a politician. And my family didn't lose their house that day, but started to feel like it was unsafe to be in Sri Lanka. And we went to India first, hoping that the violence would die down. But it didn't, and that ended up becoming the beginning of the Civil War. We went to Singapore for a bit, but my mum, quite correctly, thought that I was not suitable for that country's education system. And my dad got a job in Australia when I was 3 years old, and we've been here ever since. But when I was 8, my father and mother divorced. My mother divorced him, which is extremely unusual in our community. And she didn't have a way to earn money. And my uncle, her brother, took us in. She and I slept on the same bed for about 8 years in his house, taking up a spare room. And she turned to her dance. She was a child prodigy and as a dancer, and she came back to it and built up a dance company that put food on our table and has created some incredible shows in Australia and around the world. And the final part of that story is then that house in Sri Lanka that didn't burn down. My grandmother had taken it apart piece by piece in the midst of that war and put it on ships, and it was sitting somewhere. And she brought it eventually to Australia, found a piece of land across the road from my uncle's, and ordered some builders to put it back together painstakingly. The same staircase, the same front doors, the window grills became our gates. My kids have grown up sleeping on the same beds that their great-grandparents slept on. And we moved into that house when I was about 14 or 15, and it was a really difficult childhood. And I didn't know why at the time, and I think we'll come to that.
Yeah. So your mum, to support herself, created a classical Indian dance company. How did that shape your interest in the performing arts?
I think I got two things from it, which are not what you'd expect. The first thing I got from it was how the kind of community that gathers around a series of artistic projects can become like a family. She started teaching in my uncle's garage a handful of students and then grew it into one of the leading independent dance companies in Australia, making some incredible work. There's been 4 generations of dancers who've gone through that now, and it's like another family, you know, this group of artists who surround her work. And I think that sense of community really appealed to me, and I didn't realize how much it appealed to me until now that I have that kind of community with my own works and the people who are part of my plays. We've become like a family too. The other thing that really struck me was there's this moment before the lights go down for any show. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, you might spend the worst hour of your life seeing the most horrible thing, and you might see something that transforms you forever. When I was a kid, I remember seeing with my mum Starlight Express in London. I had no idea what it was about. And when the lights went down, a bunch of people on roller skates came out and roller skated around us and on the stage. And in that moment, I thought, if you can do this, you can do anything. The older I got, the more I realized that everything I thought was unsaid in the world, it needed to be said, and everything that people needed to talk about. But as humans, we can't find the way to talk about it in everyday life. We're too blocked. I realized the stage can do that. And I've always been attracted to that. And I say those things because the actual art, it was hard to be inspired by that and my mother's career because it was so hard for her financially. And she was so against me doing anything artistic, as was my uncle. And so there's always been a very insistent, aggressive pressure to not become an artist from my family. But I think that sense of family and that sense of incredible possibility to do anything, I just couldn't get away from it.
So what was it like growing up in Homebush, which you refer to as Little Sri Lanka?
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. I think coming out of the war starting, the first wave of people who left that war, and shout out to Bob Hawke, he created a bunch of humanitarian visas for a lot of us. It was pretty incredible. You could smell mustard seeds and oil being cooked from the balconies. You know, saris and sarongs are being dried over them. Everywhere you went were like an auntie or an uncle that knew your aunties or uncles, and it made it a much softer landing. I got to say, though, that as I got older, that became suffocating. Being inside my mum's dance company, being inside so many other Sri Lankans in the community, the thing about community and family is they get up in your business. And I guess you get older and you realize you've got to set one up on your own terms, not the one that you were brought up in. And I needed to escape that eventually, actually.
So you know, I guess like a lot of migrant communities, there's pressure to go study to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. Did you succumb to that pressure?
I didn't succumb to it, but I got it a lot. I think my uncle would call me once a week for about 15 years, asking me to get a real job. At the time, I didn't understand why he was doing it. And I felt like he wasn't respecting my journey as an artist. And my mother was very worried about it and really against almost everything I was doing. No, I never succumbed because I knew that if I became a lawyer, I would be resentful against them for the rest of my life. And I didn't want to be that kind of person to them. I did pick a middle path, though, which is your path. I did media and I actually worked at ABC and SBS for a little while. And that was the closest I could get to them thinking I had a real job and still be involved in some kind of storytelling. But when my life changed and I talked to my uncle, 2008, and we'll talk about that, I realized the full context of why my uncle was doing that. And it really, I had no idea. I had no idea what he was doing and why he was doing it. And it made a lot of sense after that.
Yeah, because it sounds like you grew up in this world where there's this really tight, strong community. And your mum's classical Indian dance company, right? So you're also immersed in the culture. But there's also a black hole in terms of knowing anything about your family history.
Yeah. If anything, I think my mum used the culture to resist vulnerability. You know, Bharatanatyam, that's the name of that classical Indian dance form that she's, one of the world's best at, is so intoxicating and mesmerizing on stage. And it offers my mother, I think, a chance to process her emotions there rather than in real life. It's not something that's unusual for artists as they get older, I realize. And she was never able to talk to me about anything. I grew up knowing nothing about why our family left Sri Lanka. I grew up knowing nothing about my great-grandfather and his involvement in politics.
Well, that brings us to the year that made me. What year have you chosen, Shakti, and why?
Yeah, I've chosen 2008 because of a conversation my uncle had with me. He invited me over to his house. And at that time, I had moved out of home. My mother, like all South Asian mothers, was incredibly angry about that and said she'd never talk to me again. And we had a very stiff relationship at that time. And I was helping my uncle with something to do with technology. That's usually why I would go and hang out with him. And he said to me, "Your mother's in trouble." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And he said again, "Your mother's in trouble. She's going to lose the home." I still remember looking out through the window of his room to the house that my mother was in across the road and thinking how we couldn't lose that house because of everything my grandmother had done to bring it to Sydney. And I asked my uncle, like, how is she going to lose the house? What's been going on? And my uncle explained to me that she'd been in debt for some time and it had gotten very serious. And it was at the point now where she was going to lose everything. According to him, my mother would disagree, but once I got a look at the finances, I think he was right. And several things happened in that moment. I thought I had got away from my community. I thought I'd got away from the responsibility to everyone there in Homebush. I was living in the inner city in Surry Hills in a warehouse. I'd started an arts company. I thought I was on this trajectory forward. I had this insane feeling as if the universe was just like taking hold of my body and pulling me in a completely different direction to what I thought my life would be. And then my uncle talked further about the financial trouble she was in, and he made it clear that he'd been helping her and that he couldn't do that anymore and that he had his own family. And it suddenly became clear to me why he had been asking me to get a real job all this time, you know? And I think in the West, there's this idea that you're supposed to follow your dreams and do what work meets your passion and what you're good at and all that kind of stuff. And it's not like that in our community. It's, well, is this kid smart? And if he's smart, how can we monetize his smartness to support the community, you know? And I'm an only child, I'm a son. And my uncle just couldn't understand why I wasn't pursuing a career that would be there for my extended family. And I wouldn't put aside my own wishes for that. And so I had a girlfriend at the time who later became my wife. She's a hero. I talked to her first, of course, and she understood and we agreed to move back home. I'll always be grateful to her for that because, you know, deciding to live with your mother-in-law and take on your partner's ancestral debt is not what you thought you signed up for necessarily when you meet someone. And we moved back to my old home and I had these twin contradictory experiences. On the one hand, I was so proud and happy to be playing a role in keeping this house from getting a wrecking ball through it. It was clear to me that I had no other option. I was not going to let us lose this house after my grandmother took it apart piece by piece. And I love that house. You know, it's incredible. I don't know, it has the kind of feeling of my ancestors in it. It just feels like our history is there in a really gentle, loving way. So I knew I had to keep that. But at the same time, I was not willing to stop being an artist. And so I resolved to keep up my career as an artist and also move back there. And the worst thing, and the most contradictory thing was, this was the start of a very difficult childhood. And my mum had been really tough with me growing up in that house, aggressive at times. I never understood why. And obviously now I got it. You know, I was back in this house and I was like, oh my God, like this was when your trouble started and you couldn't be sure we'd have food at the end of the week on the table or which of the various people you borrowed money from, the bank or various uncles, were going to start paying back. And like all that anxiety and terror, I guess, sitting under her skin, obviously when you have a child, you know, I think manifested onto me.
And moving back in with your mother made you want to start delving into your family history.
Yeah.
So that was the catalyst for your art, looking into your Sri Lankan heritage, your Tamil heritage. What happened?
Yeah, at that point, I'd only ever helped other communities tell their stories. I'd been working with First Nation and refugee communities across Australia, but I'd never looked at my own community stories or my own families. And it was impossible not to now that we're in that house. It was impossible to live every day in silence while we were literally under the same roof.
The same roof as your ancestors.
Yeah, as my mum and my ancestors, that's right. And it was not an easy road with my mum. So actually, she continued to not want to talk about anything. She doubled down, actually, refused to talk. In the midst of all of this, I was getting to the bottom of her debt. So no wonder she didn't want to talk about other stuff. You know, I was really finding out just how much money we had to pay off and how big the problem was. And I had full sympathy for her. You know, to be a single brown immigrant divorced woman in Western Sydney in the 80s and 90s, who's a dancer. I didn't mind the debt, but I was angry at her for not talking to me about it. I was really angry at her about that, for holding it as a secret. And she would not talk about the Sri Lankan stuff at all. And I went to Sri Lanka against her wishes. I started a process of talking to hundreds of Sri Lankans here and around the world. And I still have family in Sri Lanka. And when I was in Colombo for the first time again, my grandmother's sister's son, who I'm very close to, put a shoebox on the table in between us and said, "These are your great-grandfather's letters." There were a bunch of letters my great-grandfather had written to his grandchildren. And we read them to each other over the following days. And I learned that my great-grandfather was a politician. He was born as a landowner and taking care of farming land. And the first person in my family to go to English language boarding school, ended up going to Oxford, incredibly smart, came back to Sri Lanka, was the only Tamil in cabinet for the first post-independence government, and spent his life trying to fight for equality for Tamils in that country. And what really struck me was the first half of his life, he did it through moderate politics, alliances, bringing everyone together, and it just didn't work. And his colleagues betrayed him again and again. And he was one of the first people to start campaigning for a separate Tamil state. And he never advocated for violence, only self-defense. But the Tigers ended up putting that separate Tamil state in their name. It's called Elam, and they're the Liberation Tamil Tigers of Elam. So his whole career had the whole trajectory of my Tamil community in his life. And I had no idea about that. And I realized that the story of a family and the story of a country can be told together. And that was when Counting and Cracking was born. And I wrote the first draft. And in that first draft, the Australian storyline had no reconciliation. The Australian storyline had a mother and a son, and the mother just stayed mute on it all. And the son found out about the past of his family history. But I sent the first draft to my mother, and she changed after that. She'd been telling me for years this was a very stupid idea, Counting and Cracking, and she stopped saying that. She came to some developments with Belvoir, and she started to open up. And I think as an artist, she didn't know how to open up to me, a son, as a human being, as a mother. But as an artist, she knew how to open up to fellow artists in a room because it was her professional obligation. And she started saying all this stuff that I'd never heard before. She'd say, "Oh, if we had just stayed in Sri Lanka for 2 weeks after those 1983 riots, maybe we would never have left." And that went straight into the play. And all these things went straight into the play. And eventually the play became one in which the mother and the son started to reconcile as well. So as I started to piece together the story of her life and the story of my ancestor's life, Counting and Cracking emerged, the book emerged, and I started to change the way I felt about that house from being this difficult place I grew up in to somewhere I actually started to feel a sense of belonging.
And Counting and Cracking was originally mounted as part of the 2019 Sydney Festival. It went on to have a hit UK run and scooped countless awards, including 7 Helpmans and 3 Sydney Theatre Awards. Why do you think the play took off the way it did?
I mean, it's hard for me to answer that question. I still wonder about that. I think there is a kind of surprise inside the show. In Act 1, it's quite fun. And we meet these really like hungry, passionate characters. And we set up this amazing thing at the end of Act 1 where we learn that a person we thought was dead is actually alive and in a jail cell in Sri Lanka. And so people think that they are watching a fairly conventional story, but centered in a place and a time that if you're not from our community, you might not have thought about much. So that's a very good deal for Act 1, first hour. But then in Acts 2 and 3, you come back after the first interval. This thing becomes huge. Like it becomes a multi-decade saga of my community trying to fight for justice and failing. My family being one of the people who tried to do that. And my great-grandfather failing at that. Gloriously, I guess. And it becomes really about what it takes for us to love each other again when you have every reason not to, and when the forces of history and the fracturing of democracy and all your leaders are telling you not to. And I don't think audiences expect that, but I think they really need that. And when they discover that gift towards the end of the play, it becomes something they want to tell other people about.
Is it about not necessarily letting migrant Australians speak? It's more about the art of letting them take their rightful place as Australian stories.
Of course. I think the whole project with Candy and Cracking and Jungle of the Sea and the book is to step away from, to let's carve out a space for migrants to talk about themselves and to step into the stories this country tells at its highest level will include all Australians. And that's a very small but immensely important difference because it allows us to be on stage in a way that presents all our imperfections and steps away from model migrants and good migrants. And the whole argument around whether we deserve to be here or not is already a losing argument. I don't want to be part of that questioning and back and forth. You know, Pauline Hanson's very smart by trying to frame it that way. I don't believe they're the right questions or the right argument. I think Australia could go down that path of asking people to discard parts of themselves to fit in. But there's another much more beautiful conversation to be had, which is how do we set up the structures for everyone here to feel safe enough to show who they fully are in all their glorious imperfections? And that will only grow the country. It will only help it become the best version of itself. And so these plays are like versions of that on stage. And a little microcosm of Australia gets to travel through that understanding every time the show's on.
Shakti, and a new run of your second play, The Jungle and the Sea, opened at Belvoir Street Theatre in Sydney last night on July 11th. You describe The Jungle and the Sea as a companion piece to Counting and Cracking. How does it follow on?
Counting and Cracking was about the build-up to the Civil War. That was written in honour of those people who tried to stop that. Whereas The Jungle and the Sea is about a family living through the Civil War and is written in honour of those people who maintained their dignity even while their world was boiling down around them. And that play is so important and beautiful to all of us because on the one hand, it manages to uphold and show what was done to us in the Tamil community. There were multiple war crimes committed during the Civil War on both sides, but particularly from the Sri Lankan government. And there were a number of untold parts of our history that need to be said. But at the same time, talking to hundreds of people there who lived through the war, living with them, spending time with them, life goes on and they still have marriages. They still do silly and cheeky things. They still find a way to have their dignity and have so much fun. And so alongside all this truth-telling is just this kind of glorious commitment to still living with dignity, still wanting to be silly when you want to, still feeling sexy when you want to. And, you know, my mother is in this show and it's a huge journey from her to never wanting to talk about this stuff to helping behind the scenes and Counting and Cracking and now making her acting debut in this show.
Mm.
Then it'll be on in Sydney till the end of July. Then it goes to Canberra and Melbourne after that.
You've said it's very important to you to let different versions of the truth exist side by side in your work.
Yes.
And it certainly that seems to be a big focus of The Jungle and the Sea. In April this year, you received a life-changing email telling you that you'd won the Wyndham Campbell Prize for Drama. How did it feel to win such a prestigious international prize?
You know, what was incredible was none of those judges knew my work. And some of the greatest writers in history have won this award. And for them to decide that I should win it this year, having no idea who I was, just off the words on the page, really blew me away. Of course, it was affirming, but more than that, it's just, I don't think a Sri Lankan heritage person's ever won that prize. I don't think a South Asian migrant's ever won that prize. So for my community to be part of that lineage of like putting myself aside for a second, for the people who win that prize, which includes some of the best writers in history, to also include a Sri Lankan Tamil is incredible. And it opens up doors for so many other people around the world who want to follow in those footsteps in their own way. And they mentioned the judges, the thing you said earlier, which is, yeah, like I do put multiple truths side by side in my work. And it's so important. Like I think no one has the same reaction to grief. You take one family, one community, one parliament, one business. If a terrible thing happens, they're all going to have different reactions. And we are never going to find ways to reconcile or find justice or move on to a better family or a more loving family or a more free country or a better democracy if all we do is talk about how my version of responding to that grief is more important than yours. We have to find a way to sit down and listen to our neighbor's response to that grief in its fullness. And that opens up a space for them to listen to our response in its fullness. And all my work does that. And it's been wonderful to see how that also opens up those groups of people listening to each other's joy as well. And the judges did mention that. And I think that ripples out to everyone, whether or not you're Sri Lankan or not.
Shakti, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you this morning on Sunday Extra. Thank you for joining me.
Absolute pleasure on my end too, mate.
Writer, director, and award-winning theatre and film director, S. Shaktidharan, better known as Shakti. We always finish The Year That Made Me with a song. Shakti, what song have you chosen and why?
I've picked Slow Up by Jacob Banks. A friend sent me this song, and when I first heard it, I just couldn't move. It spoke to me immediately, and everything we've talked about in this chat felt like Jacob had been on the same journey. The first verse is all about surrendering to the movements of nature and history in the world. You know, you can't control everything. The second verse is about the pointlessness of violence. The third verse has this line, "The home is love." And I never used to think that. It's taken me a long time to build a life where I can feel that. But the chorus is all about, "Don't grow up on me," is the repeated line. I've got two boys now with my wife. They're 9 and 6, and I'm so pleased that they can grow up knowing everything that was held as a secret from me, and that they can step into modes of belonging that I thought were impossible. And now that they have that, I want to learn from them, you know. I learned from them how to become a child again, and it's the best. It's the best, and I think this song really channels that spirit.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.